This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. This is Dr. George, and today I have one of my favorite guests on the show, Dr. Marilyn Singleton. She is a board member of the American Association of Physician Surgeons. She's an anesthesiologist. Is that correct? And also a lawyer. So we've got someone who can talk today about all of the changes that are going on and the legal ramifications of it. Last week we talked about the clinical part of it and how clinical medicine had changed. And I'm sure you've seen this as well, Dr. Singleton, where the standard of care seems to have fallen through the floor. I gave an example last week of a patient of mine who I hadn't seen for many years, who was recently diagnosed with diabetes, and when she presented to the hospital with a sugar of 300, they basically gave her IV and shipped her out the door, didn't admit her, didn't even give her insulin, by the way, and told her to follow up with her primary care doctor. I was, like, shocked and appalled, and it just keeps going on, and I've never heard of any of this being the standard of care when I was practicing, you know, when I was an intern and a resident in the hospital. Is this something unusual in the Atlanta area, or are you seeing this out on the West Coast
No.
as well?
It's happening everywhere. And it's one of these things that we start to trace it back where things seem like a good idea, like outpatient surgery, a wonderful thing. It's anesthesia improved and facilities improved where you can monitor the patient. It's like, yeah, they don't have to spend the whole night in the hospital. But then it started to get ridiculous. You have a 90-year-old man who has no wife, has no one at home with him, and you do a hernia operation on him, and maybe it's okay for a healthy 30-year-old guy to go home that same day. But then suddenly the surgeons were asking us to, oh, could you please say he had a heart problem during surgery so I can keep him in overnight? And I'm thinking, well, I can't lie on the record that way, you know, and you'd have to decline. And these guys were desperate. They knew a 90-year-old post-op fellow, unless it was some little tiny lesion on their skin, who has no one to take care of him, cannot go home 3 hours after surgery. And it doesn't matter. You beg, appeal, whatever, and these folks go home, and they have complications. And then it ends up worse, because then they have to come in the hospital and have the hematoma, the bleeding that happened because there was no one to help them up out of the bed to get to the bathroom, et cetera. And it ends up being worse. And the poor patients, I just feel so badly for them, and there's nothing you can do about it, particularly on these government programs, because Medicare is not approving overnight stays for so-called simple procedures.
I'm with you. I used to work for a company that their job was to designate whether you should admit somebody as an inpatient, observation, ambulatory, and the criteria to admit somebody as an inpatient was kind of crazy. You basically had to be an ICU candidate to become an inpatient admission. Everything else was observation or ambulatory. And it didn't make any sense, but except when you follow the money, it did. Because if you get admitted under Medicare rules, and correct me if it's changed at all, if it's ambulatory, they're not going to pay for inpatient medication. Is that correct? Versus if you're an inpatient.
That's correct. That's
correct. You have... Go ahead, sorry.
No, I'm saying what's worse, not paying for the medication, are people who come in with these very tiny strokes, and they keep them as observation, yet they have a little bit of residual weakness, so they need to have some skilled nursing after just to get some rehab. Medicare does not pay for that, because Medicare only pays if you had been admitted to the hospital. And people were hit with these bills for a week in rehab. And they're thinking, well, I was in the hospital, and Medicare, right here on paper, it says they pay for rehab. And there was a law that was passed, not signed, that was going to stop this. It's called the observation rule, because patients were getting hit with this big surprise.
It never got passed?
It hasn't been signed. Presumably it will be signed. But one of the issues is, yes, it helps patients, but guess what? Just like you said, follow the money. It's going to cost more money, because now Medicare would have to pay for the rehab, because the whole scam behind putting people on observation was not to pay.
Exactly. It's a cost shift to the patient.
Exactly. And these poor patients think they have something. That's what bothers me, is it's not a transparent process. They make it sound like when you sign up for Medicare, oh boy, isn't everything wonderful? And then you find out the dirty truth the first time you get sick.
Well, the sad part is they have a different standard than anything else. If doctors were to do this in their office, they would be committing fraud, wouldn't they?
That's right. That's right.
But the government can get away with anything.
That's what we've learned, and it gets worse and worse. It's almost like we're the parents of the child, and you let your child get away with something, and then, oh boy, let's see what we can do next. And that's just what they do. We've let them get away with this, and they haven't been called on it. People are afraid to fight the government. Physicians, and it's no judgment, they have tons of bills coming out of medical school. You join a practice, and it's very hard not to take the Medicare money. You have to pay back the student loans and have a life. You've already put your life on hold for 7 years. All your friends from college have families and, you know, saving for a home, and you're still slogging away on call every night. So when the opportunity arises to get a practice going, I think it's pretty hard to say, oh, but don't take Medicare or Medicaid or whatever, and take your chances. And the patient, sadly, is who suffers. But the government knows that. The people behind the curtain know that these fellows and gals have to make money.
Well, talk to me a little bit about the power of the medical boards in these hospitals. I find I've had to leave as an active member of hospitals, and I've become a consult. So I don't really deal with the hospitals very much anymore, because it's just become, it's almost like you're signing away your freedom when you sign you agree to the bylaws of these medical boards. They've just become completely out of control, in my opinion. How much power do they really have, and how do they get this kind of power?
Well, interestingly, this is something that varies from state to state. And in California, that I'm familiar with, their particular law, and there are several states that have laws that are like ours, that hospital medical boards are so-called self-governing, which means the doctors govern themselves, they make the bylaws, and the hospital has quite a bit less control over it. But every state isn't like that, and all medical boards are not self-governing. The problem is, though, even in a self-governing situation, you, particularly now that doctors are going into these groups, that if you're somebody who's not in the in crowd, or you're new with a new technique or whatever, the people in the group can kind of gang up on you and submit their issues to peer review committees and get a sham peer review going. And then the hospital can step in, because then it looks like you're a danger to the patients or whatever, and get whole investigations going. And the physicians have due process and all that, but we all know just from the regular criminal justice system, we have due process, but it takes a very long time. And in the meantime, the physician's practice may suffer, his patients lose their doctor that they love.
And ultimately, if you are found guilty in the sham peer review, it shows up on your record permanently, doesn't it?
That's right. And one of the things, and this truly, I do feel sometimes when I look at these situations that occur with physicians that they can be treated like criminals, and just like a criminal, you end up doing kind of a plea bargain as such. One of the things that the physician will do in a settlement is just say, okay, fine, I'll do what you say, but you're not going to write a negative write-up of me in the National Practitioner Data Bank. And so that's kind of how sometimes these things are resolved, so the person doesn't have something on the permanent record out in the public, but as far as the hospital, everybody knows about it. The colleagues know about it. Unless you know the gory details, a person can become a pariah for no reason. And we all know how rumor mills are, and hospitals are the worst.
They absolutely are. And, you know, I've heard of things of people being written up or getting dinged with peer review for the way they speak or they're perceived to speak to the nursing staff. You know, if they're, you know, disruptive or, they, you know, they hurt someone's feelings. I mean, it's, political correctness has rippled through the entire society, it looks like.
Oh, it's gotten absurd. And the idea of this, what really bothers me, and it bothers me with this whole trigger words thing and being offended by everything, because the old days, like if you had said something to me and it set me off, you know, more than a little, where you just let it brush over your shoulder, and I say, Dr. George, that just seemed a little off. Are you having a bad day? And I'd say that to you. Now, people don't even say anything to the person, and they immediately go into the staff office. Oh, Dr. George was mean to me. And
it's amazing. It's like children.
And, you know, the thing is, it happens more and more and more that my son teaches, and he just says one of the biggest things he tries to do is that the college level is sometimes, he says, some of these, and I say kids, but I mean they're young adults, that he says they're like five-year-olds when it comes to, Johnny hit me. It's like, grow
you know
up.
What? I wish we could do that as physicians with the insurance companies, you know, and we could get some satisfaction and have them on the same level or standard that we're held to. Because they're doing a number on us, and there's no recourse for physicians at all.
No, you have to leave, and they know that. It's an all-or-none thing. You take us and all of our rules and all of our denials, or you leave it.
On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Do you have problems with sinus pain and pressure? Do other people smell things that you don't? Have you lost the joy in eating because food just doesn't taste like it used to? Is your nose always stuffy no matter what you do? Maybe you have sinus or nasal polyps. These are generally benign growths that occur from chronic sinus infection or allergies that are either undertreated or have not been treated at all. At Peachtree ENT Center, we specialize in minimally invasive balloon dilation sinus surgery and correction of a deviated nasal septum and turbinate reduction surgery that can be done in the office. We use a state-of-the-art equipment so that you can see the problem. You will be a partner in your care, and together we will decide the course of treatment. We believe in old-fashioned medicine, where we take the time to fix the problem, not just medicate the symptoms. You can rest assured that all options will be offered before surgery is recommended, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
Obamacare is failing. We all know that, but you need to know why and what you can do to get us back on the right track. Visit us at ObamacareWatch.org. This is Grace Marie Turner of the Galen Institute. Join us at ObamacareWatch.org.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Today we're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. We're having a legal as well as a medical conversation about the state of our healthcare system. I just got back from the national meeting for the American Association of Physician and Surgeons, and I came back with such vigor. So I'm ready to fight at this point. I just want you to know that. But I read an article, and I want to discuss this with Dr. Singleton about the power of the government. Under the Affordable Care Act, they now have the ability to force physicians to perform procedures which they themselves may feel are medically unnecessary or dangerous. And under the penalty of being, arrested or what would happen? Can you please go over what this new rule is?
Generally these penalties, and I have not specifically looked up the penalty for the discrimination, generally it's banishment from the system, and with some violations of the law, you get a second chance, but that's one of the things that has been changing over the years, is no second chances. It used to be financial penalties, and then if you did whatever the transgression was again, then you were banned from the program. And so that means not only that patient, you're not going to get paid for, assuming you did anything, that you could not see any other Medicare or Medicaid patients in perpetuity. But I have to honestly say I haven't specifically looked at that one, but that's generally what the penalties are with these sorts of things.
It basically puts you out of business.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And depending on what neighborhood you are or what your practice situation is, there's very few people anymore who would have 100% private insurance patients. Most physicians have a mix, and some have a stronger mix than others, and you might have all Medicaid and Medicare patients, depending on what your specialty is. And a lot of pediatricians are almost all Medicaid, depending on their neighborhood. So if you were banned from the program, that's it. Close the doors. And so there's implications that are far-reaching, not to mention all those patients that don't have a good doctor, for a rule that is fitting in a political agenda that has nothing to do with health. And basically, when I was exploring this rule, saying it was discrimination if you wouldn't do transgender surgery on a patient that asked you, what bothers me is not transgender. That's certainly a whole area where I leave that up to the psychologist and psychiatrist as far as how you deal with gender dysphoria. But it's certainly up in the air whether you do mutilating surgery. I mean, some people are all for it, do a hysterectomy and take the ovaries out before the child goes through puberty so they won't have any female characteristics and all that. And I'm thinking, oh, right, so you're going to do that? And then what if the child changes their mind? They're a child. And, I mean, this is what's so shocking to me. And I was stunned, and I have seen about six cases that already have gone before the courts in this arena. Only one has been against the doctor. The others have been against the Medicaid program for not paying for things like for men to have electrolysis and get the hair removed and all that. But the one that was against the doctors, which I found interesting, was a fellow who said he, quote-unquote, was treated poorly in the emergency room because he was transgender. Well, what does being treated poorly mean? And maybe the doctor was just a jerk, and he would have been a jerk to you or me. You know, right. You don't know that. And this is what bothers me. People can have a bad experience, whether they're black, white, transgender, whatever you may base your victimhood on. But you might have just run into a jerk. And it just leaves a very ugly door open for all of us.
Well, I can imagine you're walking on pins and needles because you don't know if you've offended somebody. And, of course, they can get the service and then decide, hey, I'm going to get a freebie by saying if my physician was a problem, and they won't be paid. I mean, all sorts of things can happen when it becomes arbitrary and subjective, right?
Absolutely.
So it's not about malpractice.
The problem is, because a physician has a practice to deal with and has to move on for the good of the entire practice, so many times when one of these troublemakers starts a problem, you just settle, get rid of it, do whatever you can to make it go away. And this is a problem. You know you're not guilty, but you've got to make it go away because you have to move on for the rest of your patients. The 99.9% that don't give you any trouble, that are wonderful people and are a joy to take care of.
I mean, ultimately what you're going to do is probably end up closing your practice or limiting your scope of practice because you don't want to deal with this sort of thing. And it hurts everybody, aside from restriction of trade, making you practice against the Hippocratic Oath, all sorts of things. And if they can do it with this, I see the next frontier as euthanasia. You know, what's there to say that the government says you're treating an illness that's not cost-effective and standard of care is hospice, and if you don't do that, they're going to cut you out of Medicare. Is that a fair assessment?
You're absolutely right. And the thing is, it's already happening. And it's done in a way like people say, oh, well, my state doesn't have physician-assisted suicide. That's a whole nother ballgame. This idea of Medicare not paying for things, well, by definition, it's saying, okay, you get no treatment. And most patients, unless, again, if they've been forewarned that Medicare is not going to pay for a lot of things, they'll start saving their money earlier knowing that they're going to have to pay out of pocket for it later. But they fool you into thinking that they're going to pay for things. And then when the chips are down, they don't. And then the patient doesn't have the money to pay for X, Y, or Z that is a treatment that they want to have. And already there's treatments that the government doesn't approve because they aren't, quote-unquote, medically necessary. And they've taken that power to determine what's necessary for the patient out of the physician's hands. They have a board of people that makes a list of what medically necessary things are. But darn it all, patients aren't machines. And what's necessary for one patient isn't necessary for the other.
That's exactly right. That's the art of medicine that I speak about. And not everybody responds to all medications. Just because you're a certain age, does it mean that you won't have a great outcome with a, quote, an invasive procedure? And it should be on a case-by-case basis. I personally think aside from the ethics of it, it'd be a heck of a lot cheaper to treat people as individuals than to put them all in one category and have all the complications and the readmissions and all the things that go on, or delayed diagnoses that cost people money and their lives ultimately.
Well, the thing that's interesting, and again, I don't mean to sound conspiratorial, but along with some of these denials came the new rules about hospital readmissions, that a hospital is not going to get paid if their patient is readmitted. But what choice do they have if they've kicked the patient out early because Medicare stopped paying for the hospitalization? They go home, they get sick, and then have to come back in, but then Medicare's not going to pay for it.
Or I'm sure we're seeing telemedicine and all these medical homes, all this nonsense with the accountable care organizations are probably designed so you have gatekeepers you can kind of treat remotely until, you know, they're an extremist and they have to be readmitted or put in a hospice situation. It's just not medical care anymore, is it?
No. It's just sickening to me. My father was a GP, and I grew up with medicine the old way, and over the years when I've seen it become so mechanized, you cringe, and then you think, well, gee, 50 years from now, people won't know any better. But that's not very much comfort to think that, oh, well, they won't know what it used to be like.
No, they're just going to dumb everybody down. It's like core curriculum medicine. And after a certain point, if you don't know what good is, you settle for the crappy standard of care. But we're talking about people's lives here. This is our future of our country. What happens when our future of our medical training, and I know that you also teach students as well. I want to talk about this when we come back from the break. How have you seen this affect the younger generation of doctors? Let's talk about that when we return. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose, and with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree ENT Center. We've won patient care awards and have the highest patient recommendations because we believe in practicing medicine the old-fashioned way. Practicing good medicine is based in listening to the patient and making a care plan that is individual. The best medical care is given when there is a strong doctor-patient relationship built on mutual trust and respect. At Peachtree ENT Center, we believe in taking care of the whole patient because healing is more than writing a prescription. Whether you have problems hearing, have frequent throat or sinus infections, from the time you call our office and speak to a real person, you will be treated as an individual and not as an ailment. During your visit, you will not be rushed and all your questions will be answered. When possible, natural treatments will be recommended to fix the problem. If surgery is recommended, cost-effective, minimally invasive treatment for snoring, sleep apnea, or sinus problems will be offered because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Before the break, we were talking about medical education. And to me, it's been like a switch turned off. And the quality of training is completely different than it was about 10 years ago. You're on the front line with medical students and residents. What are you seeing out there?
What I find interesting, and again, we kind of go back to people don't know what they're missing. Even curriculums in medical schools have changed, of where there's a whole curriculum in health systems development. I find it interesting. I think there people should know what a health system is, but I feel like doctoring is for doctors, and if you want to be a hospital administrator, be a hospital administrator. And yes, you have to know some of the nuts and bolts of medicine, but that shouldn't be a core focus. One of the things that I've found interesting, now that there's all sorts of different folks who are rendering care to patients, nurse practitioners, PAs, and who knows what else, that even some students are wondering, why am I a doctor? What's the difference?
Really?
And that's kind of a scary thought. And I feel that will we kind of become how it was in China, where each neighborhood has a grandma who kind of takes care of everybody. And it's just interesting to me. I say I almost get kind of tongue-tied about it, because I think of being a physician as such a learned, noble thing to do, and that you develop a way of thinking that is, it's almost hard to put your finger on what it is that makes you want to look globally at a patient. And unless you're a super teeny tiny specialist, you still, even though, like, you're a specialist, but it's a pretty broad specialty, and you still look at the patient as a whole.
Right.
And, you know, they always say that ear, nose, and throat doctors pick up more pre-stroke patients than anybody else, because they're handling the neck, and they feel those carotid arteries, and think, uh-oh, not enough blood flow to the head. And refer the patient on, and know how to look at everything with the patient. Know how to look at the patient when they stroll in the office. And the patient looks peaked, and you can't put your finger on it, but you know they're not quite right. And you see people getting driven down these narrow lanes with these algorithms that they're teaching now that, okay, ask the patient this. If yes, ask this. If no, go to the next thing. And it just seems a bit too mechanized and a bit too lockstep. And after a while, you may forget how to figure out that on your own. My son laughs because my husband got a GPS in his new car, and my son says, don't use the GPS. You'll start to lose your sense of direction if you rely on it too much. And in a way, that's what it is. They can't GPS you through medical school.
No.
Because you will forget how to find these things on your own map.
And it's all about thinking. It's the intellectual pursuit. It's like the detective work that goes into making a diagnosis. If you have to look at your iPad to figure out what, you know, plug in the symptom and then have it all by Watson thought out for you, I mean, what is that? He's right. Or whoever said that to you is right. I mean, what's the difference? You might as well be just a technician. What's the point of going through and the expense of going through medical school if this is what you're going to come out to be? And it's all 9 to 5 and it's all just keep your head down and don't make waves. What? But doctors aren't like that. That's not why you become a doctor. It's because you want to lead. You want to take responsibility for something, and you want to fix a problem. That's usually the personality that ends up in medical school. I don't know what kind of personality is going there now.
It's interesting because I think that personality is still in the process of applying, becoming accepted, and going.
Mm-hmm.
But what you find, and this is what's scary, is to see the number of doctors that burn out so soon. And part of that burnout is like, oh my goodness, this isn't what I thought it would be. I thought that I'd be more of the master of my own fate.
Mm-hmm.
And all this type of thing. And then they find out that that's not true. And then they burn out and talk about a waste, not only a waste of that person's life, it's a waste of their education, it's a waste for the patients that they've developed and have started to depend on them. But more and more doctors are leaving earlier than expected. So I think until there's some transition, one, my best transition would be making sure it kind of went back to the way it used to be.
Mm.
But until everybody doesn't know any better, and there will continue to be dissatisfied folks, and you hate to see that because medicine is such a rewarding thing to do.
It is. If it's left alone, you're right, it absolutely is. And I'm seeing or hearing about the suicide rate among physicians is skyrocketing, and also in doctors in training as well, so residents and people who are just in the medical profession. Have you seen those statistics?
Yes, and it's really, really sad, and especially when I see these medical student deaths, and you don't know whether they were pushed too hard and then weren't doing as well as they thought, or, you know, we never know.
Mm-hmm.
How troubled people really are. I mean, that's kind of the sad part about these things. You never really know what's going on in somebody's mind and in their private lives. But that bothers me in itself, that here you are in a small, closed environment, and you're going to a class with the same 100 people or less. I had 132 in my class, so you certainly didn't know everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But you're with this enclosed group of people, and someone's so troubled that they kill themselves. And did anyone sense it? Did anyone know? Was there anyone to talk to? And here we're in a healing profession, and you feel like it's gotten so impersonal that your colleague is suicidal and no one even knows.
That's pretty tragic. And I don't think that stress or that ability to tell someone what's going on changes as you get out into the real world and you're practicing. It's all about keep your head down, swallow something else, don't complain, and just make it work. I think we've done that as a profession admirably for the last 15, 20 years. I don't think it's going to be possible to do it for much longer. I think we're at a breaking point. I mean, this election cycle is, for medicine, I think it's do or die, frankly. And you know about the Hillary Care guidelines with that, that you want to call it a platform or structural change of the healthcare system. In your opinion, I mean, is Affordable Care Act Hillary Care light, or is Hillary Care, if Clinton gets in, will she try to implement the rest of it?
Oh, I absolutely think so. And already this whole public option idea is being floated around. And you notice and you go to the website, it's a whole mishmash of things that are thrown out there to, quote-unquote, improve on the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing we've discovered, and I think this is something patients need to know, that it's not just the law. The law is the bare bones of what the politician decides they want. Then you get people who are unelected bureaucrats who make the rules for the law. And the rules for the law are about 5 to 10 times the length of the law. So you can have a rule that really fleshes out what the law says.
Mm-hmm.
And it's practically unrecognizable. There's just such a broad discretion of the people writing the rules. And I'll tell you an example that always shocks patients when they find out, and this is something in the rule, not in the law. If you take Social Security and you don't want Medicare Part A, which they automatically foist on you when you take your Social Security, you will lose your Social Security. Not only will you lose your Social Security from the future point that you canceled your Medicare Part A, they will go back and take the Social Security that you took before you canceled the Medicare Part A.
Wow.
That is not in the law. It's in a rule. Who would imagine that, that you would lose your Social Security because you didn't take Medicare?
That's crazy.
And it generally doesn't come up. And there is a lawsuit several years ago where the people wanted to keep their own health insurance. In fact, it was Dick Armey in Congress. They had whatever health insurance, some federal health insurance they had.
Mm-hmm.
And when the judge decided the case, she said, I think this is terrible and inhibits people's liberty. But she quoted the rule. She says, according to rule, 7 point whatever, this is what it says. I have to follow the law. End of story. And so people don't know how insidious the rulemaking process can be. So I see Clinton can make these broad strokes, we'll have this or we'll have that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll say, that sounds okay. And then they make the rules and you realize how restrictive they can be. Oh, yes, you have the public option, but if you take the public option, you can't have X medicine, or you can't have Y medicine, and you can't have this surgery after 75, whatever mm-hmm. it may be.
Right. And I can imagine once it's applied to the patient and you get a mandate, a cohort of these patients, then they're coming for the doctors to rope us into the system because you have to have someone to, deliver the care. Patients just can't be in the system by themselves. And we're seeing encroachment on the ability to practice medicine, maintenance of certification, which is a scam. I hope that they're not trying some universal licensure for the medical profession. Is that on anybody's radar? Have you heard anything about that?
Oh, yes. I mean, as this is starting, there's an interstate medical license compact, and this is beginning as allowing doctors to have a license, then apply for a license in another state, kind of all organized by a single group. But that's kind of the next step to just having one national license. Now with this process, now they say, your home state still has the jurisdiction over you and would be the one that would punish you or discipline mm-hmm. you, whatever. But these things happen in steps, and that's one of the reasons that you have to kind of fear this. And this is part of the whole thing of telemedicine. Now, that's how it's linked together,
mm-hmm.
by allowing you to have these licenses across state lines. Then they're saying, that allows you to do telemedicine since the person on the other end of the telephone might not be in your same state. But frankly, I don't want somebody in Alaska telling me about my health. Again, it's one of those things that erodes that one-on-one physician-patient trust. And frankly, I just think if the doctor and the patient don't trust each other and have a connection, you lose 80% of what cures somebody.
Absolutely. It's that personal touch, and it's the art once again, and it's a connection with your patient. It seems that is the magic powder, whatever you want to say, that makes the healthcare or makes medicine work, and they're trying to systematically get rid of anything that smacks of a doctor-patient relationship.
That's right, because if you have a doctor-patient relationship, then you have open, honest discussions,
mm-hmm.
and your discussions aren't done off of an algorithm. And hello, Mrs. Smith. How is Mr. Smith? Oh, bad? No. How is your dog? You know, and those aren't the kind of conversations that we want to be having with our patients. Yes, we want to get facts and figures and a good history, but we want it to be done in the way that we know promotes a good conversation between the doctor and the patient.
And privacy. That's the key. That's also being removed from the doctor-patient relationship as well.
And this is something I think most people don't know, that now there is, as of, 5 years ago, a national information data bank. Now, allegedly, the data that's going in there, most of it is non-patient identified. But give me a break. With all these hacks and everything else, can you imagine all of our data is in one great national data bank?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't for a minute believe that it will be private. This is when I thank God that I'm just a nobody, that no one really cares to go look me up, and that if you were a recognizable name, I'm sure someone could find out everything about you. And it's what bothers me about that is, and particularly in the arena of if you have some vice that you're afraid to tell the doctor about, you can smell smoking on somebody, but you don't know if somebody's using drugs or alcohol or whatever. If people thought that could become public knowledge so easily, they're not going to tell the doctor the truth. And I had it happen to me when I was practicing in the 80s when cocaine was very popular, and I'd be doing a pre-op visit, and the person, no, I don't do this, I don't do that. And then I'm ready to inject the anesthetic, and I guess they'd think better of it, and they'd say, I just did cocaine this morning.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. The surgeon and I are looking at each other and thinking, thank goodness they blurted it out, that a little bit of anesthetic, I guess, made them want to tell the truth. But think of all the people that will not tell you the truth because they don't want it in that electronic record, because that's going to be an electronic database, and then all the treatments that you might do that are incorrect because you don't know the truth about their medical history. And that scares me, that people will feel afraid to tell their deep, dark secrets to you.
I agree. I mean, it's like that privacy, that ability to protect the patient and their information is, again, what makes the doctor-patient relationship so special. And that's being, again, it's control, it's centralized, central planning on steroids. And the people who are central planning don't care whether you live or die. They don't care about you. Why do people think? I don't understand. I love to get, from a psychiatry standpoint, why do people think that the government loves them and they want the best for them? I don't understand that. Ceding your power to the government doesn't make you better. I mean, we've seen that for the last, 12 years. The more money the government has, the more power they have. I don't see the healthcare profession better. I don't see the economy getting better. I don't see anything changed about the banking system. It seems to be the same ploy. You give the government the money, they dole it out to their cronies and whoever's the biggest lobbyist. They keep the money, and they go bankrupt and keep the money, but it's not trickling down anywhere.
Well, it's interesting because remember Marx when he said religion is the opiate of the people. Now it's become the government is the opiate of the people. And they give you just enough to keep you quiet. Excuse me. And then people think it's okay. The problem is by the time you notice the damage that it's done, it's too late. And it's like the poor Medicare, quote-unquote, beneficiaries, when you find out how few benefits you actually have.
Yeah.
It's too late by then.
It's true. Well, you know, from your standpoint, because I've thought about this, but I still can't get my finger on if the powers that be remain with the same movement towards progressivism, leftist, what does single payer really look like in your mind? Because that's what they're looking for. That's what they want. I'm convinced of that. But what does it really mean for the average person and the person who thinks it's going to be awesome and cheap, even for the physicians who think that way? What do you really think it will roll out under public or single payer?
Well, what really happens with single payer, and you really, when people say Medicare for all, mm-hmm. it will really be more like Medicaid for all.
Exactly.
Which is a system of so-called TARs, treatment authorization forms, where you won't be able to get anything until it's pre-authorized. And you don't know how far that will trickle down. I remember, lo these many years ago, when I started practice, that TARs were only for kind of special things. And then it sort of a medium treatment, a treatment that everybody does, nothing weird, nothing experimental, but you still had to get a treatment authorization form. And it's slowly but surely going to be where you have to have an authorization form for everything but an admission physical. And imagine how much that's going to slow down care or have somebody decide that you don't need that until next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I have patients that were from Canada, and every time I see her, her husband had melanoma, she'd say, he'd be dead if we were still in Canada. When they were in Canada, they were going to wait for 4 months. That was the wait they told them before they're going to, you know, do what needed to be done for this mole. Came mm-hmm. to the United States, and the next day he had a biopsy, and it was melanoma. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these stories aren't made up. And yes, everyone gets care, but it's how we kind of laugh about equality and fairness and all that, and we can say, well, everyone has equal care. Yeah, equally bad.
Bad care. Exactly. Yeah, it's not going to be state of the art. It's not going to be you get your PET scan and you get your surgery tomorrow. It'll be, well, we'll get to it. And I have an example of this. A friend of mine's sister has some sort of mass in her arm. She can barely raise it. She's been to two or three doctors. Finally ends up in an academic center. They do another MRI. It's there. And his pronouncement, initially it was going to be biopsied after the MRI. She's got Obamacare. After the second MRI, his pronouncement was, oh, it's not any bigger, so we're just going to watch it and have you come back in a year. I'm like, how can you tell what it is? She can't lift her arm. She's in pain, taking pain medicine every day. And you don't even know what it is. How can you say you cannot make a diagnosis on an X-ray or an MRI or a CT? At least get a biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, well, if you really want to, if you really, just to make you happy, you can come back in 3 months instead. I'm like, are you kidding me? This is the standard of care. I mean, as a surgeon, you never say that to a patient until you know exactly what you're dealing with. You can't say
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And you know the sad part about all this is the principle. The stated principle is we want everybody to be equal.
Yeah.
Well, what's going to end up happening? It will be more unequal than ever because only the people with money will be able to afford to go get that biopsy and say, get out of town, you guys. I need my biopsy now. And they shell out some money.
I agree with you. It's going to be two-tier.
And that's worse than how it is now.
When I was a resident, and I'm sure when you were as well, if somebody, you're in the ER covering the ER, and a homeless person came in and they had some sort of issue, they got the CT, they got admitted, they got a bath, they got the whole nine yards, and it was done in an orderly fashion with respect for the patient, that's gone. I mean, standard of care has dropped so far through the floor that I don't even know if the homeless folks get any care at this point. But if you're working poor, you can forget it. If you are middle class, you can forget it. I think if you have money and you can afford to go outside the system into a private setting, which is shrinking rapidly, that's a different standard of care. And people
that's
need
right.
to understand that.
And that's what's so sad, Dr. George, that I see it sinking. And but again, hey, but it's equal. And, you know, we can be like Cuba, equally bad care.
Yeah, social justice warriors in action.
But the sad part is, guess what? I'm sure Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Obama and everybody else get absolutely everything they want in their own private doctors, because guess what? They're more important than we are.
How's that equality
and
working for you, huh?
It's like, and don't you forget it.
In the last couple minutes, or last minute we have left, can you tell us how my listeners can reach you?
Just go to aapsonline.org, and there's all of the folks that write and come on the telephone and all that, and you can click on patient areas, and there's kind of a little list of folks and everything, and all of our information is up there. And I love people to enjoy the website. There's a lot of information, a lot of articles, and very, very useful is a list of doctors who take patients outside the system, third-party free practices. And that list is growing as these problems keep on arising.
That I'll say. I'm about to join that rank, the ranks of the third-party free practices by the end of the year, and I'm happy to say so.
Good for you.
Well, it's always a pleasure being with you. I'm looking forward to your next visit on the show. And thank you so much for your time. I know how busy you are, but you're a blessing.
Oh, the same to you. And it's always good to speak with you and your audience.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.